Yesterday, we had to break off in the middle of our look at the Song of Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 32. So let's get back into the Word at verse number 10 of Deuteronomy 32, where Moses has been directed by God to provide this memorable means of chiding the people of Israel for their sins at a future date, and why it is that God will bring judgment against them for not staying true to the covenant. So in this song, Moses starts describing the relationship of the nation of Israel from the time of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob forward, even past the time that Moses is living, because the Israelites are going to be described as being in the land and prospering there. So in verse number 9, Moses talks about how he who is his portion is his people, Jacob his allotted heritage. So this is in the context that out of all the nations of the world, which from the Israeli standard, the number of nations, that is ethnic groups, people groups, was the same as the number of the Israelites that went into Egypt in the time of Jacob and Joseph, 70, 72, or 75, depending on which text of the Old Testament manuscripts you're looking at. So that's where he kind of starts, is Israel was special among out of all of the nations of the world. Verse number 10, he, meaning God, found him in a desert land and in the howling waste of the wilderness. He encircled him. He cared for him. He kept him as the apple of his eye. That's a description of the wilderness experience. And the apple of the eye there is the pupil of your eye. And it's the way that it's used in Hebrew poetry is when someone looks in the pupil of someone else's eye, they will see themselves reflected. So Israel is reflected in the eye of God, meaning they are special to him. Verse 11, like an eagle that stirs up its nest, that flutters over its young, spreading out its wings, catching them, bearing the bump on his pinions, he who is alone guided him, no foreign god was with him. So there was this understanding that eagles, as their babies fledged, as their chicks fledged enough that they should be able to fly, they'd make it uncomfortable in the nest for them and make them have to jump out. But then they would swoop underneath them to kind of lift them up as they were learning to use their own wings. So that's the way that Israel was supposed to look at God's relationship with them. That he made them uncomfortable where they were at and got them out of there. And then he helped them get through the rough patches as they were moving forward in their life. That God was the only one that really cared for them. The idols, and they would have had idols with them in their tents during the Exodus experience, but there were nothing. They were nothing. There was no power behind those idols that could be with Israel. They were fakes and frauds and wannabes. Verse 13. At verse 13, this is where we kind of had to break off verses 13 and 14 yesterday. Verse 13 starts describing Israel once they get into the land. Now keep in mind, when Moses is composing this song, Israel is in the encampment on the plains of Moab, on the eastern side of the Jordan from Jericho. So they're not in the land yet. But now Moses prophetically describes what the future holds for them. Verse 13, he made him ride on the high places of the land, and he ate the produce of the field. And he suckled him with honey out of the rock, and oil out of the flinty rock, curds from the herd, and flock from the milk from the flock, with fat of lambs, rams of Bashan, and goats with the very finest of the wheat. And you drank foaming wine made from the blood of the grape. So you see descriptions here of agriculture and of the keeping of animals and all the wonderful products that come out of that, that the Israelis were going to enjoy once they got into the land. And then this happens. Verse 15. But Yeshurun grew fat and kicked. Yeshurun is a poetic name for Israel. It's a little bit ironic because it means upright one. And yet the description of him is that he is not upright. So Yeshurun, the upright one, grew fat and kicked. You grew fat, stout, and sleek. Then he forsook God who made him and scoffed at the rock of his salvation. So Israel gets full of itself, gets fully satisfied with life in the promised land, and then forgets that they got it because of God's gracious and compassionate love toward them. And they abandon him. They scoff at the rock of his salvation, which I've tried to teach you. Anytime we're talking about the divine name or God who holds that divine name, and you see the word salvation in close proximity there, that can be an encoding of the name of Jesus. Yehoshua in Hebrew is the name Joshua or Jesus, and it means he who is salvation. And so we can actually look at this passage, this song of Moses, and we can see the same sort of thing happening in the church of Jesus Christ. That people became self-satisfied with the blessings of God and pretty soon began to abandon Jesus and just take the blessings and did whatever they felt like. And that's never good. To accept presents from someone who loves you and then use those presents in a way that is not appropriate and even rude to the one who gave them to you is insulting. And the purpose of this song is to let the people know when you do that, God will bring judgment. Verse 16, they stirred him to jealousy with strange gods. With abominations, they provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to demons that were no gods, to gods they have never known, to new gods that have come recently, whom your fathers have never dreaded. Now, the description here of these gods, these demons, it's the idea that in the spirit world, the fallen angels try to present themselves as gods, as mighty ones. But they are not the God. They are not the Creator. And therefore, they shouldn't have ever been gone to. And yet, here in the Israeli prehistory, this prophetic representation, that's exactly what they do. Verse 18, you were unmindful of the rock that bore you, and you forgot the God who gave you birth. So that's going to be God's case against them, his legal judgment against them, is you totally forgot who it was that gave you all this stuff. Verse 19, he who is saw it and spurned them because of the provocation of his sons and his daughters. And he said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end will be. For they are a perverse generation, children in whom is no faithfulness. So that is the accusation God will make at future dates. And he will allow judgment to fall on them for that. And again, this idea of a perverse generation, you see that phrasing, that wording in other passages, other prophetic writings in the Old Testament, but more significantly, you see it in the words of Jesus in the Gospels, directed specifically against the Israelis. Verse 21, "They have made me jealous with what is no God. They have provoked me to anger with their idols. So I will make them jealous with those who are no people. I will provoke them to anger with a foolish nation." Now, if that sounds a little bit familiar, it may be because you've been reading from the book of Romans lately. Romans chapter number 10, verse 19, to be precise. Because Paul, in the section, chapters 9, 10, and 11 in the book of Romans, he was dealing with this issue of the rebellious hearts and attitudes of the Israeli people, and how they had rejected God, and because of that, judgment had come upon them, and some of them had been pulled out of the fig tree of faith, and they were being replaced by the grafting in of Gentiles of faith, those who knew no God like the Lord, and who were no people like Israel. And so Paul tries to say God himself, by bringing the believing Gentiles into the church, was fulfilling this passage right here, trying to get the Israelis who were rejecting Jesus to see, hey, God loves them because they love him. We want some of that. Verse number 22. "For a fire is kindled by my anger, and it burns to the depths of Sheol, devours the earth in its increase, and sets on fire the foundations of the mountains." So this is the fire of judgment that burns even to the places of eternal judgment, and the place where people are awaiting that eternal judgment. Sheol is the unseen place of the dead, where those who have passed on are awaiting judgment. And even after the coming of Jesus Christ, and when the righteous people in Sheol were taken into the presence of God, the people who were unrighteous remained in the depths of Sheol, where they are simply awaiting judgment day and God's fiery judgment against them. Verse 23, "And I will heap disasters upon them. I will spend my arrows on them. They shall be wasted with hunger and devoured by plague and poisonous pestilence. I will send the teeth of beasts against them with the venom of things that crawl in the dust. Outdoors the sword shall bereave, and indoors terror for young man and woman alike, the nursing child with the man of gray hairs." Now, this is all kind of a repeat of the curse part that we saw earlier in the book of Deuteronomy, that it's going to bring judgment upon Israel that was rebelling against the covenant in the form of God bringing foreign nations against them, and wars, and famines, and disease, and natural disasters. God was going to bring all of that into the lives of rebellious Israelis. Verse 26, "I would have said, I will cut them to pieces, I will wipe them from human memory, had I not feared provocation by the enemy, lest their adversaries should misunderstand, lest they should say, our hand is triumphant. It was not he who is who did all this." So in this song, Moses presents God saying, I could very well have wiped this faithless future Israel off the map. except for the fact that I don't want the nations of the world to think they won the victory over Israel. Plus, there's the aspect here of God not forgetting his promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that there would always be a people of Israel. There would always be this line of the promised seed that would be in existence. So he cannot and will not wipe them out totally, despite great amounts of sin and rebellion. Verse number 28, for they are a nation void of counsel, and there is no understanding in them. If they were wise, they would understand this. They would discern their latter end. So again, a judgment of God against these future Israelis for not even understanding in the midst of judgment that it is judgment. Verse 30, how could one have chased 1,000 and two have put 10,000 to flight unless their rock had sold them and he who is had given them up? You remember back in the blessing part that they were told that just one of them would chase 1,000 people as their enemies. But in the cursing part, it said, if you abandon me, I'm going to flip that. You guys will be the ones doing the running. Well, here, I think he jacks up the number to intensify it and points out that Israel could not possibly have been defeated in these massive ways unless God allowed it to happen. Verse 31, for their rock is not as our rock. Our enemies are by themselves. So the foreigners, the unbelieving hordes, they have idols, they have false deities. They couldn't have accomplished what they accomplished against the Israelis, who were supposed to be following the one and true living God, unless he who is had allowed that to happen. Verse 32, for their vine comes from the vine of Sodom and from the fields of Gomorrah. Their grapes are grapes of poison. Their clusters are bitter. Their wine is the poison of serpents and the cruel venom of asps. This is one of the passages early on in the Old Testament that connects unfaithful Israel to Sodom and Gomorrah. In the New Testament, Book of Revelation, God there also connects unbelieving peoples to Sodom and Gomorrah. And so this is kind of that ultimate insult for the faithlessness of people that should have been faithful. Verse 34, is not this laid up in store with me, sealed up in my treasuries? Vengeance is mine. And that kind of echoes into the New Testament. Paul uses that. Vengeance is mine and recompense or payback for the time when their foot shall slip, for the day of their calamity is at hand and their doom comes swiftly. So judgment is coming against anyone, including Israel, that tries to stand against God. Verse 36, for he who is will vindicate his people and have compassion on his servants when he sees that their power is gone and that there is none remaining, bond or free. Then he will say, where are their gods? The rock in which they took refuge, who ate the fat of their sacrifices and drank the wine of their drink offerings. Let them rise up and help you. Let them be your protection. So here we have a bit of a mocking, the idea that when they are at their last hope and they're begging and pleading with their gods and their goddesses, God is going to say, how did that work out for you? You worshiped and served these idols, these empty things, these things made of stone and metal and wood. Let them save you. You seem to think that you owed them your allegiance. How can they help you out? And of course, they can't. Verse 39. See now that I, even I, am He, and there is no God beside me. And there is the play here on the meaning of the divine name, He who is. Moses was first given that divine name when he asked, what name should I tell the Israelites? Because there's a whole bunch of different gods that they know about. And God's response was, I don't really need a name because I am Him. I am whom I am. I'm the only God. So here is Moses drafting this song for future use amongst the Israeli people to remind them there is only one true God. See now, I, even I, am He. There is no God beside me. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal, and there is no one that can deliver out of my hand. For I lift up my hand to heaven, and I swear as I live forever, if I sharpen my flashing sword, and my hand takes hold of judgment, I will take vengeance on my adversaries, and I will repay those who hate me. So God, taking an oath in His own name, saying, when I start doing judgment, when I start doing retribution, there will be no one that can stand up to that, including ethnic Israelis. Verse 42, I will make my arrows drunk with blood, and my sword shall devour flesh. That's poetic in the ancient world, but particularly here in Hebrew poetry. Arrows drank and swords ate. In fact, swords were referred to as two-mouthed if they had two edges on them, because then they could eat on both sides. So, I will make my arrows drunk with blood, and my swords will devour flesh, or my sword will devour flesh, with the blood of the slain and the captives from the long-haired heads of the enemy. Rejoice with him, O heavens. Bow down to him, all gods, or all you mighty ones, all you fake, fraud, wannabe, fallen angels. For he avenges the blood of his children and takes vengeance on his adversaries. He repays those who hate him and cleanses his people's land. So that ends the Song of Moses, the purpose of which was to be a permanent record passed down from generation to generation, sometimes orally, but always by written. Because here we have it right in front of us. It's survived transmission over 3,500 years. This written record was to help the people know later, this is why you're being judged. This is why you're having to leave the land and have your temple destroyed and have your capital city destroyed and all your other cities destroyed. It's because I am bringing judgment for your rebellion against my sin. Then, when we get to the book of Revelation that I told you earlier, in chapter number 15, the Song of Moses will also be sung around the time that the seven wrath events take place. Because the people who take the mark of the beast, even though they are warned by God's own public announcements by angels not to take it, those guys will experience the full wrath of God. And so the Song of Moses will be sung in the heavenly realms by those martyrs who have been killed by the members of the beast leader's kingdom. All right, back to Deuteronomy 32:44. Moses came and recited all the words of this song in the hearing of the people, he and Yehoshua, the son of Nun, Joshua. his attaché, and the next leader of Israel. So they take the time to teach this song, this poem put to music, to some key people amongst the Israelis so that it will be passed on hereafter, and also to make sure that it's written down. And that's why we still have this song to this day. Verse 45, "And when Moses had finished speaking all these words to all Israel, he said to them, 'Take to heart all the words by which I am warning you today, that you may command your children that they may be careful to do all the words of this law.'" So Moses is really, really pushing it. You've got to stick with this stuff, folks. "For it is no empty word to you, but your very life. And by this word, you shall live long in the land that you're going over the Jordan to possess." So he wants them to get it right so that they can live long. And then we introduce what we'll talk about tomorrow, and that is God's final instructions for Moses before he goes to his death. Verse 48, "That very day," so the day he finished the writing down and the giving of the poem, the song, "that very day, he who is spoke to Moses, 'Go up this mountain of the Abarim, Mount Nebo, which is in the land of Moab, opposite Jericho, and view the land of Canaan that I am giving to the people of Israel for possession, and die on the mountain which you go up, and be gathered to your people, as Aaron your brother died in Mount Hor, and was gathered to his people, because you broke faith with me in the midst of the people of Israel at the waters of Meribah Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin, and because you did not treat me as holy in the midst of the people of Israel. For you shall see the land before you, but you shall not go there into the land that I am giving to the people of Israel." So Moses, get yourself ready. We are moving much closer to the moment that you're going to pass away and leave the Israelites to go into the land of Israel without you.